Thank you very much, Damien. So it's a pleasure to come chat with you. In fact, I have two daughters who are about to start high school next year. So for me, this is almost a moral obligation. So today I'm gonna tell you about this Event Horizon Telescope, why we're doing it, what we're hoping to learn, and why I think we live in a revolutionary time. So having a chance to share modern physics with a lot of young people is a very special thing. And I think many of you might recognize this from the press materials of a movie that's now, I guess, a year and a half removed. And one of the unique elements of this movie was scientific accuracy was touted as a selling point for a blockbuster, which, you know, was a foreign notion to me. So I was really excited. But by this time next year, we should have pictures of real black holes that look like that. Okay, and so I'm going to tell you how we're going to do that, and some of the interesting things we can learn, fundamental physics things we can learn about black holes, and how they interact with stuff around them. Now, I said this is an exciting time to be doing this, and it's because we're not the only group, the only experiment, the only way to study black holes out there. And I think many people have heard just a few months ago about the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, seeing gravitational waves for the first time. Truly dynamical events in general relativity, huge amounts of energy. At one moment, this system that is just a couple little wiggles on a plot on one slide outshone the rest of the universe. Magnificent experiments that we hope to learn an enormous amount about the gravitational physics of black holes from. There's also other experiments like ELISA, which will measure black holes in a very different mass range from space, or pulsar timing arrays, collections of telescopes around the world who are very carefully monitoring pulsars and checking the arrival times of pulses from those and using those to back out information about gravitational waves. So it's not just LIGO in the game. There's a whole bunch of other gravitational wave observatories doing this as well, and they're due to see something right about now as well. At the same time, electromagnetic astronomers, what until earlier this year were called astronomers, have been studying these sorts of objects for a long time as well. And there's a whole lot of phenomenology associated with them, from radio images of jets, which I'll talk about briefly in a little bit, quasars, galactic microquasars or X-ray binaries, gamma ray bursts, relativistically broadened iron lines, et cetera, whole bunch of electromagnetic signatures that we have. And so now as we enter, I think, the era of experimental strong gravity physics, one of the key things we're going to be doing moving forward is figuring out how to relate the dark side of the universe to the light side. And there's a lot of synergistic opportunity there. Who knew Star Wars was so on point? But let's begin at the beginning. So what is a black hole? By extension, why should we care? The answer, like to so many questions, is it really depends on who you ask. And if I'm a physicist, which is probably true everywhere else outside of this building, when I come in here, I'm a proper astronomer, but outside, I'm a physicist. What is a black hole? A black hole is really something that's dark. Okay, it's a compact object whose influence is only felt gravitationally. This is not a relativistic idea. Okay, the idea of black holes goes back prior to general relativity, and it comes really just from the idea of escape velocity. You throw a baseball up, and if you're a major league pitcher, it goes out a long ways, maybe not this far, and then it comes back down, and as you throw it up harder and faster initially, it goes up further and further, and there's some maximum radius it gets out to given an initial velocity. Okay, so that defines an escape velocity. We know rockets roughly get higher than that. For the Earth, it's about 11 kilometers per second. For the sun, it's more like 600 kilometers per second, but you could imagine shrinking the sun down, making it considerably smaller, driving it up, if you made the sun 7,000 kilometers, size of the Earth, about 6,000 kilometers per second. If you drove it all the way down to 3 kilometers, so you crush the sun from its normal size down to something that's 3 kilometers, you get an escape velocity that's equal to the speed of light. Okay, that was recognized by John Mitchell. A couple centuries ago, he called these dark stars, and he said these would be things whose influence would only ever be felt gravitationally, tugging on luminous things around them. And this is a Newtonian idea of a black hole, and that's really two centuries ago. Okay? And the size of this thing, which I'm going to call R sub S, not R sub M, Schwarzschild radius, is about right. What you get from the escape velocity is the right number, in fact. So it's not really a new idea. As of 1918, we had general relativity telling us how we should think about black holes, and the Newtonian idea that apples fall because of a force at a distance was traded in for space-time and space-time curvature. Okay, succinctly described by John Wheeler, space-time tells matter how to move, and matter tells space-time how to curve. Okay, and Karl Schwarzschild from the trenches in World War I found the first solution to Einstein's equations, non-perturbative solution, and that's the Schwarzschild metric, and that describes a black hole. Okay, and the characteristic thing about these objects is they're extreme curvatures of space-time, so extreme that there's a point at which light cannot even climb back out of the gravitational potential well. In some sense, this is similar to the idea of the Newtonian black hole, except stuff never moves one iota up past where it started if it's inside the horizon. Okay. Why study black holes? Well, the answer is the no-hair theorems. And I am told that this is not, if you study black holes long enough, you lose all your hair. Although I'm not taking any chances, you may have noticed. They're really a statement about black holes being simple. They're these extreme manifestations of general relativity, but they are fundamentally simple. They're describable by three numbers: their mass, their angular momentum, their electric charge. And that's sort of surprising, because if you look at other things in your life, they're complicated. Certainly a rhinoceros and an SUV are not described only by their mass. They're very different things. And that extends to the rest of the universe. Okay, things come in a variety of shapes, sizes, compositions. It's complicated. But black holes are simple. Three numbers, that's all you need. In practice, you really only need two, because in an astrophysical black hole, there are enough free charges floating around that it always shorts out any charge. Okay. So what kinds of black holes then do we have out there in our astrophysical experience? They all come down to this gentleman, Roy Kerr. He took Schwarzschild's solution, which has zero angular momentum, and extended it to the case of an object that's spinning. And the no-hair theorems are effectively telling us this is the only solution. If you told me the mass of the object and the angular momentum, Roy Kerr's solution is it. These are Kerr black holes. And so what do they look like? What is their general features of their space-time? Well, the first is, of course, they have that horizon, the point of no return, abandon all hope. Another thing they have, which is fundamentally different from the descriptions of Newtonian gravity, is an innermost stable circular orbit. Right? And this is kind of a foreign idea. We know that as things get closer to the sun, they have to orbit faster, right? Because the gravitational pull is getting stronger, and it is the gravitational pull that provides a centripetal acceleration which holds them in orbit. And so they have to orbit faster. Okay? And so, you know, fundamentally, that's all orbital motion is. It's this balance of gravity against centripetal, providing the centripetal acceleration. But one of the fundamental tenets of general relativity is something called the equivalence principle. All forms of energy gravitate, okay? And because energy gravitates, it's not just your rest mass, but also your orbital energy gravitates. And so now you kind of have this runaway. As you get closer, gravity pulls on you harder, you orbit faster, but now you have more energy, you gravitate more, gravity pulls on you more, you orbit faster. It's sort of like paying off one credit card with another. You can get away with it if the balance is 10 bucks, but if it starts getting to real money, you're in trouble fast. And the same thing happens here. And there is a distance that's characterized just by the space-time at which you lose. And that's called the innermost stable circular orbit. There are no orbits inside of that. Okay. There are other key points or key places in the space-time. One is where a photon would orbit. You'll notice it's sitting inside of this ISCO. This photon orbit's unstable. The photon tried to start off in this orbit very quickly, it would diverge. But this is where the Keplerian velocity would become close to the speed of light, or equal to the speed of light. Okay. And inside of that, another unique feature of general relativity is the ergosphere. So this is the point not of no return, but of dynamical space-time. In general relativity, space-time is not a static stage on which everything proceeds. It's a dynamical thing. You know, it pulls itself around, it moves. This rotating black holes are dragging space-time around in their vicinity. What does that mean? You could imagine staring at the stars at night from the surface of the Earth. And if you did that, you'd see them move because there's the surface of the Earth is moving. But you could get into a fast jet plane if they would let us and travel 1,000 miles an hour, go in the other direction, and you would see the stars stay still. Okay? Outside of the ergosphere, you can do the same thing with a fancy enough rocket. You could travel in the opposite direction of the rotation of the black hole, and at some point, stars far away would stay still. But once you get to the ergosphere, your rocket has to go the speed of light. And inside the ergosphere, faster than the speed of light. So inside the ergosphere, there's no way you can go fast enough to keep the stars fixed far away. Your frame of reference is being pulled around by the black hole. That doesn't mean you can't get out. If you turn your rocket going out radially, you can still escape. But it means that you're seeing a dynamical universe. Okay? So that's all 20th century black hole physics. Isn't this the 21st century? Why are we still talking about this? The Kerr solution was obtained in the 60s and early 70s. Well, one of the questions that keeps me up is, how does strong gravity work? Is this picture right? And why would we be worried about that? Well, right around black holes, general relativity is not a small correction to Newtonian gravity, to the gravity that we've tested so exceedingly well in our own solar system. It's 100% different. It's totally different. Okay? And there's really two places where that happens. One is near black holes, like I discussed. The other one is if you imagine making not the radius small, but the mass very, very large. Okay, so this ratio is the gravitational potential. When this is of order unity in dimensionless units, then this is when we're in this 100% difference regime. You make the mass large. Okay, and so you can imagine making the mass of order one hydrogen atom per cubic meter. You can make the radius of order 10 gigaparsecs. And again, that's one. You might recognize this is about the mean density of the universe. This is about the size of the universe. Okay, that doesn't mean the universe is a black hole, but it does mean you better learn general relativity if you want to be a cosmologist. Okay, and it means that this is another place where gravity is 100% different from Newtonian physics. Everything else in the universe and all the places where it's been tested are between these extremes. And they're all at much lower gravitational potential. So all of our intuition for how gravity works comes from places where general relativity is in large part a perturbation, with perhaps the exception now of the gravitational wave observations. Now, on these very large scales, there's something very surprising that we've discovered in the past 20 years. Right? You and me, the Earth below us, all the stars you see in the sky make up 5%. Right? That's the major modern discovery of cosmology. We have dark matter and now dark energy, which comprise the remaining 95%. And in a very real sense, that's the price of strong gravity working like general relativity tells us it does. Okay, this comes from assuming that general relativity is right on those scales and asking how much stuff we needed. And there are people in this very building who are trying to come up with ways to change gravity so that you don't need 72% of the mass budget of the universe to be dark energy. Okay, so that's a real question. We don't know why that is. Maybe it is true that it's filled with other stuff that makes up the dark matter and other fields that make up the dark energy, but far from obvious. At black holes, we have very little idea. Okay, so this provides us with another place to look for how does this strong gravity behave? Is there something that feeds back onto large scales, tells us about the universe? Do we have any hints on whether or not Einstein was right? So that means we have some big questions, existential questions. Do black holes exist? I mean, are there things with event horizons? Do we know how to describe them? Does our physics actually tell us how stuff behaves in their vicinity? That's what I would ask if I were a physicist. If I'm an astronomer, I would note that black holes are hardly dark objects, right? Black holes plus stuff are the brightest things in the universe. Here's Kip Thorne again, pondering his picture from Interstellar. And it does highlight the fact that they're enormously bright, powerful things, and that's because they're not isolated. Here's a picture in the optical of Centaurus A. There's a galaxy. You see these nice dust lanes. Everything that you see in white are stars from the galaxy. I think these are stars in our galaxy. So this is an edge-on disk galaxy. And if you look at it in the radio, all of a sudden you reveal these enormous jets emanating from the very center. Okay, these are the result of the active galactic nucleus. These are the result of a supermassive black hole sitting down at the center of this galaxy. So it's not sitting there doing nothing. It's having an enormous impact on its environment. Just to illustrate how significant this can be, here's 3C279, one of the prototypical quasars, okay, accreting supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. It has a luminosity of something like 10 to the 47 ergs per second. It could easily be 10 times that. What is that in real units? It's 10 to the 41 watts. It's 10 to the 30 times the total power output of Canada. It's 10 to the 13 times the power output of the sun. So this does not just outshine its own galaxy, it outshines its 100 closest friends. Okay, it's one supernova every 15 minutes. Compare that to the rate of supernova in the Milky Way, about one every 100 years. Okay, enormously powerful. Okay, and there's also funny features like that jet that we saw in Centaurus A. There's another one just in the radio. Large, thin projections coming out from the center of the galaxy. This is measured over 100 kiloparsecs or so. The record holder extends over 4.5 megaparsecs. How far is that? That's many times the distances between galaxies like the Milky Way. Intergalactic impact coming from the centers of these objects because they're interacting with stuff. Okay. Black holes look like they come in two varieties. One is the thing that lives at the center of galaxies, like Centaurus A. The other are the things that LIGO might be seeing merging, stellar mass black holes. There might be a third class, but nobody really knows if they're there. Well, I'm going to talk about these supermassive guys at the centers of galaxies. So here's a visceral impact or picture showing the impact of these objects. Here's a galaxy cluster. So we have many galaxies all orbiting each other. Everything you see in white are stars. Everything you see in blue is cluster gas. This is shown in the X-rays. And the red stuff are the remnants of the radio jets driven by the black hole. And the point here is that they're not incidental. It's not just a cool thing in the night sky to explain. It's actively carving holes in this intercluster gas. It's controlling how gas falls down on galaxies and turns into stars. It's ruling the fates of these galaxies. So if you really want to understand how galaxies work, how they grow, why they look the way they do, you need to understand the way black holes operate down near at their smallest scales. And this impacts things like the velocities of stars in the galaxies in ways people don't really understand. So if I were an astronomer, then I'd want to know, how do you produce these luminosities that are 100 times brighter than their parent galaxies? And how do you launch these outflows that impact the universe around them? And I'm going to show you how we're going to do that by direct imaging. So first, let me mention a little bit about the targets, the things that the Event Horizon Telescope is going to look at. And it's really a study in contrasts. So we're very fortunate that we have a handful of things we could look at, and they're all exactly the sorts of things you'd want to look at. Now, the first is the black hole at the center of our galaxy, our own personal active galactic nucleus. It's a 4 million solar mass black hole. It's 8 kiloparsecs away, half a galaxy away, okay, center of our galaxy. It's extraordinarily underluminous. It's almost a non-active galactic nucleus. And we have exquisite, and despite being underluminous, it's extremely luminous in the radio. So here's a picture of the galactic center shown in the infrared. It's right where the arrows are. If the arrows weren't on the screen, you'd be forgiven for having no idea where it is. It's being outshone by moderately largest stars. In the radio, it shows up like a smoking gun. It's a very bright point source. In fact, the brightest point source in that region of the sky in the radio. In fact, that's what its name means, brightest radio point source in Sagittarius. We know its mass extraordinarily well. It is probably, I have to go back and look at how well LIGO measured the masses of its final products. But I think it may still be the best measured mass of any black hole known to science. And the way in which that's done is by watching stars orbit around it. So here are actual pictures, a movie of the observations showing stars moving around it. And they're weighing the black hole just like you'd weigh the sun, by carefully watching those orbits, reconstructing what those orbits were, and inferring from Kepler's laws what the mass of this dark thing at the center is. And it's in fact exactly John Mitchell's experiment, watching how the dark thing tugs on the bright things and inferring its existence and mass. The other object that the Event Horizon Telescope, high up on the Event Horizon Telescope target list, is M87. So in some respects, this is exactly the same as Aggier star. It's extremely dim. Okay, so it's a nearly non-active galactic nucleus. But in critical respects, it's different. It's 2,000 times more massive. This thing has the mass of the brightest quasars in the sky. It has a powerful jet, which you can see extending over many tens of kiloparsecs. And here is a zoom-in picture. And in fact, extends all the way down to near the horizon. Okay, so it looks like one of those sources that's impacting dramatically its vicinity. And that means that we really have an opportunity to study many different elements of how black holes interact with stuff. With Sagittarius star, we think we can look at what happens for most of the black holes in the universe, where there's not a whole lot of gas around them to accrete for some reason. They don't do a whole lot. And for M87, we can look at this as a laboratory for jet physics and understand why those outflows are formed and how they impact their galaxy. Okay, so that all sounds like a good story, but in practice, what are we up against? The real problem is that black holes are compact. They're compact objects for a reason. Even though they're enormously massive, 4 million, 7 billion solar masses, enormously compact. How compact? If I were to take the Earth and try to squish it into a black hole, all I have to do is drive its size down. It would have a diameter of about 2 centimeters. So it would look like a squash ball, vastly smaller than the thing on the screen. If I wanted to take the sun and crush it to a black hole, we already heard that's about 3 kilometers. That's about the size of Waterloo. The galactic center, it is a black hole, and it has a diameter of about 30 Schwarzschild radii. So I can see the sun on the same picture. I draw a size of the horizon. M87 is about 300 astronomical units across, and that puts it somewhere around the boundary of our solar system. So we're talking about solar scale, solar system scale objects, and we want to see these half a galaxy away or many, many galaxies away. And that gives provides an extreme challenge in the size, angular scale we need. Also, what does a black hole look like? There you go. If I'm a physicist, I'm all done. It would be convenient if I could get someone to backlight it, because if you backlight it, interesting things come out in silhouette. It doesn't look quite that exciting. There's a Schwarzschild black hole silhouetted against a uniform background. What we're really seeing are all those photons that would have followed a trajectory that began near the horizon. And the bright things are the rays that connect to our distant bright background. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of bright backlighting for black holes provided by the universe, but we do have black holes that bring their own lighting. Okay, the size is about 10 or 5 Schwarzschild radii divided by the distance to them. Bring their own lighting, here we are. So here's an example of an accreting black hole, and all that stuff, and I'll talk about why it shines so much, all that stuff rushing headlong towards the horizon lights up and shines, and so you can think of black holes as bringing their own lighting crew. So even though we don't have a uniform backlighting for these objects to see them in silhouette, we do have a number of bright objects that exhibit structure on exactly this silhouette scale, 10 gm over dc squared, so 5 Schwarzschild radius in angle. Okay, and what is that for our objects? Well, ignoring Earth scale or solar scale black holes halfway across the galaxy, for the galactic center, Sagittarius star, the thing at the center of our galaxy, is about 50 microarcseconds. And that's the target scale. That's the difficult thing. How big is that? That's a poppy seed in Vancouver. That's a grapefruit on the moon. Okay, so that's the scale we need to resolve. And there are fundamental limits to what kind of scales you can resolve in practice. And these have driven telescope evolution in part. Here's the first telescope I had. Here's the one I have now. That's a massive upgrade. The key element in all these things in modern telescopes, especially the one I have now, is this large mirror. Okay, and the key element of the mirror is that it helps collect all the light incident on the aperture and bring it to focus all at the right time. And so I'm a sucker for silly mnemonics, so here we go. All the light when the time is right. All the light comes off the mirror and comes back at the same time, and that's what the parabolic mirror does. Okay? And the history of telescope development has just seen making bigger ones. You can buy 24-inch telescopes now, which is just crazy. If you look at the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, they have 2-meter class telescopes. Okay, the biggest telescopes in operation today, 8-meter class telescopes, so giant mirrors. You might have heard of the 30-meter telescope. Okay, they want to build that in Hawaii, but maybe that won't happen there. All in evolution towards bigger and bigger mirrors. And there are two reasons for that. The first is bigger mirrors allow you to see dimmer objects. And the second is bigger mirrors allow you to see higher resolution objects or smaller scale objects. Okay, and the limitation presented by all these telescopes really comes down to diffraction. And so diffraction shows up every time you have waves. So I've heard you've all been hearing a lot about quantum mechanics. Okay, so this is fundamentally quantum mechanics of light in operational context. But anytime you have waves, so here's a picture that shows water waves going through a strait. They start off relatively ordered, they hit the strait, and they make these kind of beautiful crescent patterns, bent patterns. Here, the order, the direction of the waves is very clear, right? They're all very ordered. Everybody's moving in lockstep in one direction. But as soon as it goes to the strait, it gets bent around, having gone through a finite width object. And so it's kind of hard to tell what direction the waves are moving. Are they moving in this direction or that direction? And that's diffraction. You're familiar with this if you've ever driven at night. You can watch television or movies, and you'll see all these beautiful star patterns around distant bright lights. You can work out the shape of the pupil of the camera from those. This is just diffraction. If you look at them with your eyes, you'll see sort of a random starred spiky thing. You can use that to measure the shape of your pupil. Again, it's just diffraction. It's just the wave nature of light coming through the fixed aperture, just like the water waves moving through the strait. And when you look at stars through a telescope, there's an aperture, and you get a diffraction pattern. And that limits the resolution of a star you can see to about the wavelength divided by the size of the aperture. Okay, and for my telescope, that's about 600,000 microarcseconds. Remember, 50 is the key, so I'm not doing this from the backyard. This is completely understandable in terms of the wave optics of a telescope. It really comes back to all the light when the time is right. Here was the original picture. You can imagine asking, what does right mean? And how far off axis could I get and still see it when it's right? And the answer is you only can tell what's right to within about a period of the photon, okay, or a spatial distance of about a wavelength. And that gives you exactly the same condition. So I'm not doing this from my backyard. What about this next generation of telescopes, the 30-meter telescope? Well, I have bad news. Somebody left off a few orders of magnitude. If you want to do this with optical telescopes, you need to go up to 5 kilometers. So we need the 3-kilometer telescope. 30-meter telescopes runs about a few billion dollars. So that's not happening. If you were imagining going to longer wavelengths, right, this resolution goes as wavelength divided by distance, it just gets worse. At a millimeter, you have to make it the size of the Earth. But we know how to do that. Now, the idea is not to bring all the light into focus off of a mirror, but instead measure the light at the surface, at the aperture. And instead of using a mirror to bring it all into focus, you bring a giant computer and use that to bring it all into focus. You record the light at each site on large packs of essentially hard disk arrays, and you time delay them appropriately and bring them all into focus, bring them all in, bring the light all together when the time is right. Okay? And this is a technique that has been utilized for a long time now called very long baseline interferometry, and there are already telescopes out there the size of the Earth. Here's one, the very long baseline array, and it has stations all around North America. Okay, just enormously large, effective telescope, and has angular resolutions of hundreds of microarc seconds. And so that picture I showed of M87, that was actually taken with this very long baseline array, and it measures things on scales of milliarc seconds or even fractions thereof. Okay, so not 600,000 microarc seconds, maybe 1,000 microarc. This isn't quite good enough, right? 100's bigger than 50, so you have to do better than that. Making the Earth bigger is expensive. So instead we look at shorter wavelengths. That also solves another problem. That is, we're looking through the galaxy to see the black hole at the center of the galaxy. We're looking through the stuff around M87 to see the stuff at M87. So if you look at too long a wavelengths, you're either foiled by the stuff you're looking through becoming opaque, or stuff in the galaxy scattering your effective images, so looking sort of like through a frosted windshield. And so going to a shorter wavelength solves both of those problems at once. So in some sense, a fortuitous trifecta. We get high enough resolution, we can see through the source, and we can see through the galaxy. And so the Event Horizon Telescope is exactly a very long baseline interferometer, telescopes spread around the world, that operate at that 1 millimeter. And I used to have to give talks talking about how it was going to develop, but I'm very excited to say that all the stations that you might imagine bringing into the array have been brought in. Successful experiments have been done at each individual station over Earth-sized baselines, seeing the galactic center, seeing M87, have been performed. So the Event Horizon Telescope's a reality. And as of next year, we'll be able to potentially start making pictures. Also like to point out that the Event Horizon Telescope is not a first light instrument. Okay, it's not something where you spend all your money and all your time building it up, you turn it on, and you just hope that somebody polished the mirror correctly, right? It's something that gets built up piece by piece and has been operating for almost a decade now. And there's a proto-EHT, it's three stations spread out over the globe that have produced enormous data set that we've already been able to say quite a bit about. And I'll talk about that in a bit, in a moment. One key thing to mention up front is that already we have measured or detected sub-horizon scale structure in both of our primary target sources. So I can say right now with absolute confidence that there is stuff that's black hole sized in those targets that we are actually seeing all the way down to the bottom. So as additional sites are added, okay, so the proto-EHT is what we started with, we fill in the mirror. I showed many little radio telescopes spread throughout the mirror. We fill in effectively the mirror. And so here's an example in radius filling in the mirror, but here's probably the better example that shows the rotating Earth and individual pairs of telescopes and what part of the mirror they fill in. So you can think of this thing as effectively being the size of the mirror presented to the object. And at each moment, we fill in a different location, and so if you wait through a night, we actually fill in the mirror pretty well. And that means that we really are talking about imaging. I'm going to skip over the details involved in getting from here to here and just highlight this was an image we put into a simulation, and this is the image that we recovered. Okay? And so this is the sort of thing that we think we might be looking at. This is the sort of picture we can make. And I'll say more about those in a moment. This isn't specific just to this kind of model. We can also do this for sources that would be, or models that are appropriate for M87, for those jet sources. And again, the same thing holds. We put in a model, we get with high fidelity back the model, and you can see in all of those the impact of the shadow of the horizon. Unfortunately, I said that even though, you know, there's a proto-EHT, it's been operating for nearly a decade, unfortunately, with only three stations, we don't fill in the mirror. Okay, so here's the mirror, and here's the points at which we've measured the light. And that's not nearly good enough to make a picture. Okay, so how do we go beyond just a handful of points on this on the surface of the mirror? And the answer is context. So my youngest daughter's name is Anna. As you can imagine, very quickly, somebody noticed it rhymed with banana. So we like to tease her. She doesn't really like bananas now. Here's an example where I've taken a photo. And I've only sampled a few pixels from it, exactly those pixels where we have information about the light hitting the you know, our Earth-sized mirror. And if I asked you, what is this a picture of, you might be hopelessly confused. There's no idea. It's got some yellow and some white. But if I told you it was a picture of Anna or a picture of a banana, and those were your choices, I think we very quickly would know. Right? And I think this just illustrates the power of context. Okay, if I have a prior, if I have an idea of what I should see, then I can start making fine distinctions. And so that's the idea for us. Now we have rather limited coverage on that mirror. How can we exploit context and say deep things already and make predictions for what we're going to see in the near future? And so I'm going to give you three cases where we're beginning this process of making context and show you some predictions for what we're going to see. And the first is really an existential matter for the Event Horizon Telescope. It's really an empirical test of whether or not event horizons are there. If there are no event horizons, we have rather inauspiciously named the instrument. And the argument I'm going to make I didn't miswrite it. I am not, therefore I am. I'll explain what that means. So the first thing is, what kind of context should we have? We have to have some sort of model for the source in order to exploit context. And the simplest model you might attempt to use for any astronomical object is just a blob. It's a thing with a size. And different size blobs produce different size images, but correspondingly produce power in different distributions across the mirror. Small blobs produce power at large scales, medium blobs at intermediate scales, and big blobs at small scales. And that's how we've gone about, even with just a handful of pixels, constraining the size of Sag A's star to 37 plus or minus 0.5 microarc seconds. Okay, so by using this prior model and measuring the light across our mirror, across the globe, we're able to say something about the size of the emission region. Okay, and then we might ask, where does all that light come from? And I said that black holes plus stuff are the brightest things in the universe, and in the center of our galaxy, there's a lot of stuff. We can see it in the X-ray. There's a whole lot of gas surrounding the galactic center. We can see it when we look at the size of the galactic center as a function of wavelength. As you go to longer wavelength, it becomes more and more opaque, and it gets bigger and bigger. So we're seeing a nested structure of stuff converging on the center of our galaxy. We can see it in polarization transfer information. There clearly has to be a lot of stuff right around the black hole. And so we know Sag A star is powered by a substantial amount of material accreting on. Okay, and it is this accreting material, this material that's falling down the deep gravitational potential well, that makes black holes the brightest things in the universe. And if you've ever gone to Toronto, gone up the CN Tower, I'm sure many of your students will have imagined throwing things off. I'm not sure if it's more socially acceptable to throw pennies off or to spit off of it, but in either case, don't do it. Were you to do it, though, we all know that the penny would gain energy as it fell down the gravitational potential well of the Earth, and it would follow Galileo's prediction of gaining velocity at a constant rate. Okay, so the potential energy as a function of height is going up linearly with how far it's fallen down. Had you tried such a thing, you might be a little disappointed, because the penny is never actually going to get going that fast. You know, this guy's a large cross-section. At some point, it's going to go fast enough that the drag force on the penny is going to slow it down. It will reach a terminal velocity, and thank goodness that saves all the pedestrians. Where does the energy go? The energy goes into heat. It's heating up the air as it falls down. Okay? That's exactly the source of accretion power. For the Earth, it's not a whole lot. It's about 1/1,000,000th of the rest mass of the penny would go into heat if you dropped it all the way to the center, or all the way from infinity down to the surface of the Earth, I'm sorry. For a black hole, which is very much more compact, stuff falls a much further distance, much longer way, and a much larger fraction of the rest mass of the stuff can be converted into heat, converted into energy that can then radiate. So really, the source of power for Sag A star and the source of power for 3C279 quasars is this energy release as stuff falls down into the gravitational potential well. And that luminosity can be close to just the rest mass that's falling per second into the black hole. For a typical quasar, it's about 10% of that value. For Sag A star or M87, it might be about 0.1%, just because it's a somewhat different kind of system. But this is the origin of that energy. What this looks like for things like black holes and things like stars, though, is very different. Okay, so for a black hole, this accretion luminosity is emitted as it's falling down. Gas is rushing headlong towards the center, rubs up against gas next to it, heats up and shines. But then it finds the horizon, passes right through, and that's it. For a star, it's a little different. It starts off the same, gas rubbing and heading down towards the surface, heats up and shines. But then it goes splat on the surface of the star. And all the remaining kinetic energy gets converted into heat, in this case, in your bag of rice. And in the 90s, if you were a movie in a very lucrative way, you know, here's an impact crater from an asteroid, and all the energy here is just this energy at impact. Just gravitational potential energy made manifest. Okay? That means that we have a way to start assessing this existential question for the EHT. Do black holes exist with event horizons in the universe? And the statement is yes, and the argument goes, we know how big the thing is. It has to be relatively small in comparison to the shadow. So we're going to presume the emission region, whatever it is close to the black hole itself. Okay. And if you were going to imagine replacing the horizon with a star, now some crazy phase of material that we've never seen before, you know, super neutron star, or alter gravity, so now you don't actually have a horizon and stuff falls down to the center of some moderated potential well and produces a photosphere, then all of a sudden we're going to get light from this very compact region. And that light is just this surface luminosity. The key thing about this, though, is this is sort of an inverted version of the black body cavity. Because most of the light that's radiated from this surface can't get away. It's bent back by gravitational lensing, by the extreme gravity, back into the object. And so you should think of this not as light being emitted from the surface of the star, but this pinhole cavity that defines how we think of black bodies. The photons scatter many times on the surface before getting away. And we know exactly what that looks like. That looks like thermal emission. And thermal emission has a characteristic spectrum, so we know exactly where to look for all of this extra gravitational energy that should be present if there's a surface. Now, in the radio, you can't see it. But at infrared wavelengths, it will dominate the luminosity of Sag A star. So here's a picture of an object that's not a black hole that has a surface. And that surface is shining with a given temperature here. And it comes up and stops right about where it should be if all of the material raining on to Sag A star, raining onto the black hole at the center of our galaxy, released that extra kinetic energy and radiated from the surface. Over here is the spectrum. And we have a number of data points, actual measurements of the infrared spectrum. And you can see by the time it ends, this is way above all of these data points. This is excluded to as many sigma as you want. Okay? This isn't there. There is no surface. Okay? So black holes exist. You can do this not only for Sagittarius, you can do this for M87. The answer is the same there. To many, many sigma, this is excluded. Event horizons really exist. The Event Horizon Telescope, the name is okay. Yeah, that's an existential question, though. And I always like to point this out to to reporters that whether or not black holes existed was all the rage in the 70s and the 80s when we first saw galactic microquasars. And you know, you just kind of assumed that you didn't really know. Was this a neutron star or a black hole? Are there things that could be more massive than the maximum mass neutron stars you can think of? It wasn't until Wheeler really went to town on this and showed that above three solar masses, what else could it be? But that was it. That was the definition of a black hole. What else could it be? And here we're showing stuff is going in and light's not coming out. I am not, therefore I am a black hole. We don't see it in the infrared. Can't be a region where all this energy comes out. The next thing I want to tell you about is, I think, key to some of those astronomical pictures. How close to being right is our idea of how black holes interact with stuff? Validating astrophysics. How do they grow? How do they impact their environment? Accretion onto black holes, this accretion power, I've just mentioned sort of as falling, dropping stuff straight down the gullet of the black hole. But you may have noticed, hopefully with some relief, that the Earth has yet to accrete into the sun. Yay, that's right. Okay, maybe many of you aren't looking forward to next year. So why is that? Well, it's angular momentum, right? It's the orbital motion. Okay, as you try to shrink the orbit, angular velocity increases to keep angular momentum fixed, et cetera, et cetera. So the story of accretion is really a story of how to rid material of angular momentum so it can fall deeper in. Okay. And angular momentum transfer, it's sort of a knotty problem, but there's two very different regimes in which this can happen. The first is if you have a very high accretion rate, angular momentum transfer can happen very slowly. Stuff spirals in on very near circular orbits. During this time, the disk efficiently cools and becomes very thin. This is like a pancake. But for most objects, the accretion rate's very low. And that produces something, ironically, that has rapid angular momentum transfer. Stuff plunges in on near radial orbits. It just wouldn't move in on the circular orbits. It can't efficiently cool, and it produces big, puffy, hot disks. Okay, and this is sort of a canonical picture for things like Sag A star and M87. So again, context. There are a lot of things we don't know about how this works in practice. Theoretical unknowns. We think we understand qualitative terms how angular momentum transport happens, but quantitatively, there's still real questions. And there's still questions about what's doing the emitting and how does it get the energy to emit in the first place, and that's the detailed plasma physics questions. But this isn't a free-for-all. And sometimes I think science has this sort of staid reputation. We read facts out of books. We do very well-defined experiments. But in fact, scientists are extraordinarily creative people. They're just suffering with a whole host of rules. I like to say we're creative writers, but we have to write poetry in the old rhyming sense, rhyme and meter, not prose. Okay, and that's in this context, just the other kind of leverage we have. We think we know something about how hydrodynamics works, how gas moves. We think we know something about how particles emit. We think we know something about gravity. And we also have observational confines. We don't have absolute freedom to make anything happen because we have a whole bunch of other observations that have to be satisfied. And between those, we can construct a family of models for things like the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And here's a picture from one of them. And it's this kind of big, fat accretion flow picture. It uses the mass estimates. It uses the spectrum of the galactic center. It uses some of the polarimetric information and various other things. And what goes into this picture is, first and foremost, gravitational lensing. This is the shadow of the black hole. This is the picture I keep showing you. That's what this big ring is. At the same time, it, like everything in my talk, has a dark side and a light side. So we have an approaching side. The disk is orbiting. The accretion flow is going around. And the side coming towards us is coming towards us at relativistic velocity. And so it's Doppler beamed towards us and Doppler shifted. And so it ends up looking brighter and slightly optically thick. And the side going away from us, beamed away from us, and Doppler shifted in the other direction, it ends up being darker. And that's sort of the characteristic set of pictures in every effort to make images of these black holes for the EHT. Gravitational lensing plus Doppler boosting. It also depends upon the details of the black hole, the details of the space-time. Here's a case for Schwarzschild's black hole, so no angular momentum. Here's Kerr's maximally spinning black hole. This is a black hole spinning as fast as it can. And they look very different. And so here's our context. Okay, here's our Anna and Banana. And we can go ask, can we already say something? And the answer is yes, we can say something about black hole spin. And this is a very difficult figure to see because there's three different spin parameters to worry about. There's how fast the black hole spins, and then there's two directional angles. I don't really want you to try to unpack that figure in any meaningful way, only to look at, say, the center panel and marvel at the large sea of blue. This is low probability. This is excluded. Okay, so just by having that context, we can already say a tremendous amount about what the spin of the black hole in the center of our galaxy can be, what direction it could possibly be pointing in. And just to impress upon you what that means in terms of images, here's a collection of images that are consistent within one sigma with the EHT data. I assure you they're all different. Okay, so they're actually pretty close. And so I think this is a striking validation already that if nothing else, this accretion flow paradigm of this hot, puffy, thick disk with plunging gas that people have been talking about for 10 years now, maybe 15 years now, this really is a viable picture, may just be the right picture. And I could go further and convince you, or try to convince you that the parameters you back out make sense in the context of other observations as well. But I'm just going to say, I think we can say with some confidence that the kinds of accretion flow models we've been talking about make sense. We also have measured polarization. And polarization allows us to get at the structure of the magnetic field. And that, in turn, tells us something about how that angular momentum transport that drives accretion happens. I mean, the standard picture for how the angular momentum is transferred is that magnetic fields couple regions at different radii. Magnetic fields have tension, so you can think of these as stretchy bands. And so they couple the angular momentum, they couple the motion of the material, and they transport the material by torquing stuff on the inside, pulling back on stuff on the inside, and pulling forward on stuff on the outside. And so angular momentum is transported in the standard picture by these magnetic fields, which are stretched and pulled by the turbulent motions in the disk and preferentially tug back on the gas. And so this polarization, it turns out, tells you something about the structure of the fields. And the reason is because the light that we see in the radio is generated by electrons that are whizzing around these field lines. And as they whiz around the field lines, they go in one direction primarily, and they emit polarization in the direction of their motion. So these guys are polarized this way, these guys are polarized this way. Okay? And just last year, we published the first polarization measurements on horizon scales of the black hole at the center of the galaxy. And we saw something rather surprising. We saw polarization on large scales. Okay, this is the small Mir scale, right? So that has a large angular uncertainty, was low, around 10%. Polarization on large scales, or small scales, I'm sorry. So that's large scales. The large Mir size, small scales, okay, high angular resolution, was like 50%. So the polarization went way up when you started to resolve small structures. Okay, and that means we can start constraining the kind of magnetic dressing that you can put on black holes. We know it's not this. Okay, we know it's not this because if this were true, we would see small polarization on all scales. We know it's not this because if this were true, we would have seen large polarization on all scales. It has to be something intermediate, something that has no structure on large scales and lots of order on small scales. Okay, and that's exactly what our standard accretion flow pictures predict. You have order on the orbital scale, so close to the horizon scale near the black hole, but you have randomness on larger scales. So in the last few minutes, Now that I hope I've convinced you the EHT was not unfortunately named, and I hope I've convinced you that we're starting to say interesting things about astrophysics and how black holes interact with their environments, let me tell you about how we're hoping to answer that question, was Einstein right? Does strong gravity work the way we think? How we're hoping to measure the shape of space-time. No, I'm fairly simple. I'm a theorist. My idea of observations can involve rulers and my computer screen. One of the things you might try to do is just measure the size. Right? The size of the shadow is dependent to within 10% on just the mass of the black hole and the distance to it. Okay, so just putting a ruler across the image already says something very deep. And you can start comparing that mass ratio to distance, m over d, to other measures of the mass and the distance to the black hole, the center of the Milky Way. We have astronomical measurements like masers. Those stars orbiting provide another set of measurements of mass and distance. If you put them further away, it could be more massive. If you put it closer, it could be less massive. The nuclear star cluster provides yet another. And the Event Horizon Telescope provides a third. And you could imagine trying to compare or combine all of these, and that produces a better measurement. But I think a much more interesting way to look at this is in analogy with the double pulsar mass measurements. So in this case, when you have two orbiting neutron stars, there's a number of relativistic effects that you can measure that depend only on the two masses, nothing else. And if you measure two of them, you measure the two masses. But if you measure three of them, you now have a test of general relativity, because all of those have to correspond to a single solution for the two masses. And so when you look at all those double pulsars measurements that constrain the two masses, they all have to cross at a single point. And the same thing is true for our mass distance measurement. All of these measurements for the mass and the distance have to cross at a single point. And the EHT provides something very different. Okay, masers are just geometry, but the S stars are measuring something about gravity, but they're measuring it out much, much further away than the EHT sees. They're measuring out at a tenth of a parsec, okay, at things that are 100,000, 10,000 Schwarzschild radii. Places where Newtonian gravity dominates everything. It looks almost exactly like Newton's theory. The EHT is seeing stuff right down near the horizon, so we're seeing general relativity. And this had better cross at the same point. Okay, and so that's a nearly model independent test for the correctness of general relativity. So that's the first thing we'll do. The next thing you can do is you can start to ask, what happens if Roy Kerr is wrong? What happens if that's not the only solution? Can I modify the space-time curvature and see the impact it has? And Roy Kerr's statement is that you need mass and angular momentum. Those are the only two parameters you need. There's a quadrupole to the space-time, but it depends just on those two. Well, we can break it, we can deform that. We can just change the underlying metric we put into our calculations and see what happens. And that changes the shape of the shadow, the shape of the accretion flow images. In one case, we made the black hole more like a football. In the other case, we made it more like a discus. Okay, here's a Schwarzschild case. It looks sort of like a soccer ball. Okay, if you like candy. Right, so you know, we squished the space-time. We saw the impact it had. Remember that this is the level at which things can be distinguished, so we can already start constraining which of these pictures makes the most sense. And when we did this a number of years ago, the answer is everybody made as much sense as everybody else. It was sort of a depressing, this is how you could do this stuff in principle. A few years later, I had a student revisit it, and he made this picture, and he was very despondent, you know, very apologetic. Hey, look, you know, practically everything is included in these 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours. You know, again, we're just back in the same place, proof in principle. And he didn't understand why I was bouncing off the walls, and I said, look, Carlos, there's dark blue. We've made a measurement of something. We've excluded something. So already we can start to say that general relativity is order unity correct near black holes. Next year, it's going to look like this. When the full array operates, note the limits. These are percentile measurements, forgetting even what these two parameters are. This is black hole spin. This is how broken GR is. Percentile measurements. Okay, so we're looking at sub-percent tests of the shape of space-time using deformations of the Kerr metric and the EHT the next year, next couple years. Next thing we could do is imagine trying to take a CAT scan of the space-time by looking not at stationary stuff, but at dynamical stuff. About once a day, the black hole, the center of our galaxy, flashes in the infrared. And it actually becomes as bright as all those stars in its vicinity. It does this in the X-ray, infrared, and also in the millimeter where the EHT looks. You should think of these as solar flares. These are solar flares in the accretion flow, in the big puffy accretion disk around the black hole. And what might those look like? Well, something will pop off. It'll be a compact emission region. It'll orbit the black hole. We'll see it multiply lensed, it'll die away, and then a day later, another one will pop off. And it'll happen at a different radius, maybe at a different phase in the orbit. It'll go around at a different speed, again we'll see it lensed. And those different lensed pictures encode information about the structure of the space-time. Okay, and they encode different information because the photons that produce the different images have taken different paths through the space-time. And so you can imagine taking these and directly measuring the shape of the space-time in a manner that's not all that different from how they take multiple pencil beams of X-rays to CAT scan your head. It doesn't just have to happen with total light. You can do this with polarized light. And in fact, you don't have to make images at all. You can just measure the position of the polarized light relative to the unpolarized light, and measure where then this spot is in the orbit around the black hole. And again, that encodes information about the structure of the space-time. And again, you do this at many different flares, many different radii. And in all cases, you had better have exactly the same result, exactly the same underlying black hole structure. And that's a test for the underlying, measuring the underlying shape of space. Now, one thing with all of these different ways of trying to go beyond GR is I've written down 4, and I think that's very important. Because if I came to the scientific community and I said, hey, look, GR is wrong, we made a measurement, they would rightly say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and you've come to us with a picture and a ruler, what are you doing? And so I think it's critical for us to be able to cross-validate. And so these are 4 very different ways to get at the same sort of information. They should be plagued by different sets of systematics. They couple in different ways to other kinds of observables. Okay, so one of the things that's critical about the way that we want to go after the shape of space-time here is the ability to cross-check. amongst the group. Okay, so finally at the end, I note this is the sort of picture we have. This is our favorite best fit model. This wasn't chosen arbitrarily. This was chosen because it's the model that currently best fits the data. I'll leave you with a picture of what we're going to see, and let the era of strong gravity begin. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very exciting talk. We have time, I think, for a few questions. Maybe we might limit it to three now, but I believe Avery is going to stick a little bit around afterwards for dinner, so he'll be around. So if we don't get your question now, we'll try and get to as many. Just so we can keep on time, we've got one question up the back there.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit. How do you do interferometry without physically combining the light?
Right. So in the radio, there are two answers. The first is, in the radio, we have a high photon occupancy number. What that means is we're not collecting light one photon at a time. We're actually seeing the full electromagnetic wave. And so you're counting phase fronts. It's really a classical experiment. The right answer is really no. It's still a quantum experiment. It's still quantum mechanics. There's still photons. It's just you don't know which one you recorded. So you make a weak measurement to figure out where the phase fronts are. But really, what you've really done is entangle your recorders at all sites, which you then go do the proper quantum mechanical interference measurement on a computer back at one location. Okay, so we don't actually have to interfere them at the same time as long as you maintain their entanglement throughout the process, which happens just because we can't measure enough information to localize a single photon.
Okay, do you have any other questions?
No.
Do you think your experiment results will prove GR, or do you think it will break it, or disprove it?
People who have bet against GR have not been right yet. I hope that it disproves it, because that would be much more interesting. Most of the models that we're going to explore are going to be close to GR. I mean, we look at alternatives, but we're going to look at things close to GR because it's been so successful so far. Mm-hmm. It's not up to me.
Just think of the grant money.
Yep. The two targets you're talking about, M87 and Sagittarius A, how did you choose? You got lucky that their spins are perpendicular to the spins need to be perpendicular. What is it if you're looking at something and the spin axis is pointing at us?
So M87 is actually very close to pointing at us. It's somewhere around 25 degrees away from pointing right at us. Maybe 10 degrees away from pointing right at us. There's no real limitation on where the spin points. The key thing that matters for us is how big a shadow they cast on the sky. The angular resolution of the EHT is fixed. And if you want to see shadows of black holes and measure near horizon structure of stuff, you need to have a large enough object that's close enough. And so both of those are, they're respectively first and second on the ordered list of largest angular size black holes on the sky. M over D is what matters.
So those images you were showing there on the screen with you were showing the rotation, the brightness, but it doesn't need to be somewhat perpendicular to see that?
So for Sag A star, that was, their inclination was 60 degrees from the line of sight.
Yeah.
The reason, we make models where we're looking straight down the jet, right straight down the black hole spin. There's no real evidence of a jet in Sag A star. Look, right straight down the black hole spin axis. Those are disfavored by enormous amounts. So either we're totally wrong in our modeling, which is always possible, or I think more likely Sag A star has a large inclination angle, but 60 degrees.
Any other questions? Well, I have a question. Is there anyone talking now about kind of a next generation experiment beyond the HT, possibly you know, people talk about LIGO and then, you know, put them in space.
So is it not hard enough? yeah, so there's always technological development. There's a lot of very specific technological development to push EHT's capabilities. We don't call it EHT advanced or anything like that, but in order to make this work, since it's expensive to build new telescopes, we just come up with more sensitive ways to use the existing telescopes. And the key thing to do there is increase bandwidth. Bandwidth means high recording rate. So we have 64 gigabit per second recorders. So those are the fastest unclassified recorders, right? Beat the pants off CERN. I don't know about the NSA. But developing that technology has been one direction it's going. The other thing is there are people actively working on how to do this from space. There are space-based radio interferometers. There's one up there right now, Radio Astron. Operates at much longer wavelengths, so it would be a very difficult experiment. And you really have to worry a lot about telemetry. You got to get a lot of data down in a relatively short amount of time. That's hard, but people are thinking about that now.
One more question. So if you were talking to someone, maybe a high school teacher, maybe was interested in teaching something about black holes, but maybe...
Where would we find a high school teacher?
But maybe you didn't have a lot of time or et cetera. Is there any kind of key points you'd really kind of want them to get across or any advice?
What are the key points of black holes? So I think as an astronomer, The one of the things would be accretion power. It's not really special to general relativity, but the idea that black holes are the brightest things aside, I guess the gravitational wave events are black holes too, the brightest things in the universe and have an enormous impact, that's both inspirational, right? You can be small and have a huge impact. That's good. You shouldn't weigh a million solar masses. But I think that's an important idea. As far as the physics goes, the idea of a dynamical space-time, the idea of ergospheres and horizons, I think, is a key idea, right? The idea that you can be swept up, the space-time can be swept up under your feet. And that underlies a lot of this astrophysical phenomena. It underlies a lot of what people see in LIGO.
Last question.
Yep. So with black holes, we always are told that, you know, light cannot escape them. When we talk about Hawking radiation, could you just briefly explain or kind of how that radiation escapes, but light doesn't?
So the first statement is, when we say nothing can escape from a black hole, that's a purely classical statement. Mm-hmm. Hawking radiation is a semi-classical thing. So it's not purely classical. So what is the picture that makes sense within the classical, canonical classical picture of black holes is the idea of creating virtual pairs, and one of them gets lost, and now the other one has to get away. And that's Hawking radiation. In that picture, nothing ever actually comes out of a horizon. It's, some element of a black hole absorbing negative energy, right? I would also point out, though it may be heresy, nobody has yet observed Hawking radiation. And I'm kind of a stickler for making sure these things have been seen. So there are people like Bill Unruh who are trying to do this in black hole analogs, which I think is a Herculean and heroic task, but which might be redundant. But it's a very different thing from the sort of emission that I'm talking about, which is all produced by stuff outside doing classical things. There's the classical picture, the virtual particles, and one never actually comes out of the horizon, something falls in preferentially, and the other thing is, the universe is made whole, the other thing becomes real.
Well, thank you very much.